Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Robert Aberle. Bob is professor of philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. He's been on the program many times before, and I know he has a lot on his mind that he wants to talk about, and I always have a lot on my mind. Let me just start off mentioning that there's a big anniversary coming up next week. I think probably a lot of listeners know what it is, but for those who don't, it'll arrive on the 23rd of December. I call it a day that will live in infamy. Indeed it will. And I have an article that I saved. It was written a few days ago. I saved it to get it out early in the week. I'll get it out tomorrow. It'll be top featured on my blog site, Steve Lenman Blog. And I call it 100 Years of Financial Terrorism. Well, I thought that was the best way to describe the Federal Reserve. What else? You know, there are all kinds of terrorism, and really financial terrorism, other than nuclear annihilation, is probably the worst terrorism I know, because, you know, wars affect the countries that wage them, and financial terrorism, the way it's waged, is a global offensive against the rights of ordinary people. Not millions of them, billions of them, many billions of them, the great majority of people. Well, on the 22nd of December, the House members passed the Federal Reserve Act, and then a day later, in the middle of the night, the Senate followed suit. A lot of them had already gone home, but there was a majority there, and they passed it, same in the House. They passed the law. Woodrow Wilson signed it. Woodrow Wilson, a former law professor. He was a tool of big money. He was the same Woodrow Wilson who campaigned in 1916 for re-election, pledging to keep America out of the war. You know, the one that began in 1914. And when it ended, it was called the War to End All Wars, in a pig's eye. It was a warm-up. Well, there have been a lot of wars before that. But you could say this was the first world war. You know, a world war is not necessarily a war that involves all parts of the world. Certainly, World Wars One and Two were not that, but they certainly involved quite a considerable parts of it. I mean, Europe, North Africa, Asia, that's a big chunk of the world, I would say. America has never had bombs fall in its territory. Let's hope that never happens. Let's hope that nobody ever has bombs. Well, they're falling right now. Wish there were a way to stop it. Anyway, as soon as Wilson got elected, he began the first major propaganda campaign in U.S. history, sophisticated propaganda campaign. And America was very pacifist and very isolationist in those days. And he literally, over a period of a few months, managed to turn pacifist Americans into raging German haters. It was an astonishing campaign. And it taught corporate America a big lesson, that the power of the message is really compelling. And a lot of what came later in advertising and the rest of propaganda, including government propaganda, followed what Woodrow Wilson did. And I remember writing about this some years ago. Anyway, America got into the war, and but before it began, Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act. He's also the one who signed the Espionage Act and the companion built to the Espionage Act the following year. I mean, Wilson was a real tyrant, an absolute tyrant. He claimed to be a Democrat. He's no more Democrat than Obama is a Democrat. I mean, he was an imperial tool. He was a tool of big money, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And then he had the audacity when it was too late. I quoted him verbatim. It was a long quote, but it started off saying, "I've destroyed my country." As if he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, the guy was a law professor. I don't know what he knew about finance, but he certainly knew an awful lot about the law. And the Constitution's Article 1, Section 8, which I'm sure he was very familiar with, anybody can look it up and see what it is, says only the Congress has the right to coin money. Well, I take that as a term that was used in those days. So I take the word coin to mean print. And if the Constitution were written today, it would have said print, not coin. The only money America controls are coins. And they're a minuscule amount of America's money. And the Wall Street-controlled Federal Reserve owns the rest. And indeed, they have rained 100 years of financial terrorism on ordinary people, not just in America, but on a worldwide basis. Oh, my God. On the 24th, they go into their second 100 years. Hopefully, we can find a way to get rid of them. One quick comment, and I'll let Bob jump in. I don't agree with Ron Paul and most of the things that he supports, libertarian ideas, but there's certainly one I do agree with him on very strongly. He is the only one in Congress ever, several times, to introduce the Federal Reserve Abolition Act. He had no co-sponsors, all by himself, out of 435 House members. So 434-1 was the situation. Well, he didn't run for re-election in last November, a year ago last November, 2012. So he's a private citizen now. I quote him in my article. He made a comment about the Fed's anniversary. I quoted him. I thought it was appropriate to quote him because he certainly has been on the right side of this issue for a long time. I personally would like to see the Fed nationalized. Central bank for a country is just fine, but it shouldn't be in the hands of private profiteers. It should be in the hands of the government. Why should the government pay interest to Wall Street on its own money? The only time it didn't do that was during Lincoln's Civil War. My comment's getting a little longer than I thought, Bob. I'll wrap it up very quickly. In the Civil War, the bankers, there was no Federal Reserve then. Closest thing to it was the Bank of the United States way back, and it had to be its charter had to be renewed every 20 years. And Andrew Jackson called it a hydra-headed monster. He refused to renew the charter. That's another story. Madison was very very anti the kind of stuff that the bankers did in those days. Jefferson as well. We don't have people like that around today. But the bankers wanted to charge Lincoln in the Civil War 24-36% interest to finance it. Well, he basically told them to go to hell. He had Congress passed the Greenback Act. It gave the Treasury the right to print its own money. He financed the Civil War interest free. Why should the government pay interest on its own money? Why should it give bankers the right to charge it? In 1913, the same year that the Federal Reserve Act passed in October, so just a couple of months before it, the Income Tax Act was passed. Well, one of the amendments, I forget the number, it's in my article, 16th, might have been the 16th Amendment, Income Tax Act. Why was it passed? To pay so ordinary people would be the ones to pay bankers' interest on government's money. That's what the income tax was all about. That's why it passed. There was a tax during the Civil War, and it disappeared when the war was over. There never was a federal income tax other than then, but it came into being so that bankers could be paid interest and let ordinary people do it. Bob, let me let you jump in. I could go on and on this topic. I mean, both my books are on this, How Wall Street Fleeces America and Banker Occupation, and there's plenty on the Fed in both of those. Bob?
Oh, you ready for me? Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a lot of content in what you're just saying. There's a lot to respond to. If I could just kind of run it up to the current time regarding the Fed. We know that Bernanke has had his press conference, his outgoing press conference, and we saw him say that he was going to try to phase out the quantitative easing. But until that actual detail comes up as to what that means, how he's going to phase that out, they're still injecting $85 billion a month into the Wall Street financial market system. They're not doing it for the people. They're doing it as a monetary stimulus for the banks and the stock market, so that keeps going, and they're continuing to record record profits. I mean, profits in U.S. corporations in the third quarter were up close to 20%, 18-something percent, just in the past year. So they now make up a greater share of America's gross domestic product. Well, that's who Bernanke and the Fed is financing, because on the very same day, Congress started talking publicly about slashing the food stamp program. And cutting out worker entitlements and benefits for people. So you can see right there, just in a couple of days this past month, where the difference is between what the Fed is doing and what the people need them to do. So I would just tag that on to what you were saying about your article, which I'm sure you've got contained in there. But when the Fed comes out and says, here's what's going on, there's a real lackluster job market right now, and the economic indexes are not doing really well right now, so we're going to keep quantitative easing in place, well, that goes right to the wealthy. It doesn't go to the people. It doesn't help people buy homes or keep food on the table, and that's part of the problem that you're talking about.
Oh, exactly, Bob. And even though the Fed announced a $10 billion cut in quantitative easing, I believe he at least suggested it'll begin in January, so down from $85 billion a month to $75 billion, buying either U.S. Treasuries or toxic mortgage-backed securities sitting on Wall Street banks' balance sheets, just removing them. In other words, you know, they made the bad investments, and the Fed is bailing them out. But the tagline in his commentary was that he'll print as much money as the bankers need.
That's the idea, right?
He can call it quantitative easing. He can call it cheesecake. He's going to print as much money as the bankers need.
And that's the problem, that even when he says there are going to be cuts that are coming, you're right, he said, let's start with $10 billion. We don't know that that's going to be maintained, and the other side of that is exactly what you said. We'll print as much money as we need for that. In the meantime, Republicans and Democrats come up with their own austerity budget, which we can talk at length about, but it slashes all kinds of worker benefits and people, common people benefits, retirement benefits of federal workers and military retirees. It does a whole lot of things. It has no provision for extending federal jobless benefits. On and on it goes. So you pair that up with what the Fed is doing, and you can see exactly what the class war is that's going on in the United States.
Oh, there is a horrendous class war, and of course it's been going on for many years, for decades, Bob, at least since the end of the 1960s. Throughout the 70s and the 80s, 90s, and it's been raging post 9/11, and raging more than ever under Obama. I mean, literally, the handouts to the Fed and to the other big corporations have absolutely been unconscionable. And at the same time, as you mentioned, they're cutting food stamps, and they made one cut, and they plan more cuts, and they want to gut Medicare, privatize it. Same thing with Social Security, hand them both over to Wall Street, reduce Medicaid benefits. This is the policy of America, what I call neoliberal harshness. And at the same time, they're lavishing billions and trillions of dollars on the corporate scoundrels, the profiteers, and the war profiteers that just milk the country out of so much, and ordinary people are left high and dry.
Except the big CEOs, the corporate executives. There was a report that came out back in November, this past month, that, I'm trying to remember some of the stats from this. The top 10 CEOs in the United States received an average of $100 million in salary alone in the year 2012. And that the two top executives received over $1 billion for each. So you know where the money is, and where the money is in America, that's where the power is. And so when you've got money and power that come together, which is what you're seeing with the libertarianism, straight neoliberal perspective that we've been talking about, essentially, you have what many people have referred to as fascism. Fascism is kind of a wide-ranging category, but certainly it is the case that with fascists, there's a real hostility to what we would traditionally call a liberal democracy, where the people are in charge and that the power is shared equally and that there is some level of equality between economic classes. But you don't see any of that at all. And the notion of fascism, even though it kind of contains within it this nationalistic category where everybody has to be an advocate of the nation, you don't really get that today so much. But the idea is certainly a totalitarian one where monopolized power on every aspect of society comes about when you have the economic elite that are making, 1,000 times, 6,000 times, whatever it is, what you or I would make, and parlaying that money into political power. That, by any definition, is a totalitarian state. Now, you can call it a fascist state and use that wider category, and that's all fine, but totalitarian regimes, by and large, seek to control every dynamic of society, and that's what we're seeing right now. We can talk about it economically, and that's certainly the case, but even with the NSA surveillance, which we can get into, and the other issues of the day, like the Detroit bankruptcy and the Chicago cutting of Rahm Emanuel cutting the pension funds for the city workers, all of that is all part of the same idea of a totalitarian form of government. It's completely irrational, it's completely unethical, and most of all, it's completely undemocratic.
Bob, it's heading increasingly closer to the Bilderberg Group's literally dream. Their longstanding dream that goes back many, many years is to create what they call a classless society, but it's anything but that. It's a ruler serf society where literally a tiny percentage of the population has all the wealth and power, and the great majority, you know, 99% plus, people turned into working class serfs, the ones that actually have jobs, and you've got repressive police state laws on the books to crack down hard on anybody who resists the system, and that's their ultimate dream, along with a lot of other things like turning NATO into a global police force and literally militarizing every country and having supreme control with absolutely no challenge whatsoever, a borderless world, and these power brokers control it all. This was Nelson Rockefeller's dream. He's still around. I think he's around 97 years old. Well, I don't know that he'll be around to see this fulfillment of the dream. I hope I'm not around to see the fulfillment of that kind of dream. But that's what it is, and it's getting there incrementally. It really very, very slowly, Bob, so most people don't realize what's going on. And then you get a smiling face like Obama, who's nothing but a super con man. I mean, every word out of his mouth is a lie. People haven't wised up enough to realize it. His approval rating is down because some of his policies, like his Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare, is not turning out exactly the way he wanted. People are catching on slowly that this thing is a monstrosity. Well, I mean, they haven't seen anything yet. They're having trouble signing up. But wait till they find out what happens when they have a serious illness, and if they don't have enough coverage, or even if they do, they have to pay a whopping big percentage of the cost on their own. And how many people can afford that? So Obama could end up going out of office, possibly even as America's most unpopular president. He might pass Harry Truman, of all people, and George Bush, very close to Harry Truman. And Obama right now is hovering around 40%, which is, I think on one poll it was about 37%. And, I mean, everybody should catch on, because the people most harmed are the ones who are generally his biggest supporters.
Yeah, the last poll I read had him at a 36%.
Really, oh, brother.
Pretty low. But, I mean, it could conceivably go lower as people do catch on to this. And I make mention of this to my students, mainly outside of the confines of the classroom. But I say, you know, Obama, from the beginning, is just a snake oil salesman. That's all he is. And he's got the smile that comes with you've mentioned this author a number of times, the fascism to come, that fascism with a smile, you know, fascism with a friendly face.
Oh, Bertram Gross?
Bertram Gross, that's it. That idea of fascism with a smile, you could certainly see that with Obama. And it really puzzles me that the people would be entirely committed to the party over the principle so that they can't see the smiling face and what's behind it. You know, it's pay no attention to that man behind the curtain type of a denial. But if the idea that Obama has been trying to get across in, I guess, late November and December in some of his public speeches is that he is a great opponent of inequality. And you may have seen his speech, I think it was on the 4th of December, earlier this month, the first week of December at some point, where he started talking about the top 10% takes in more than a third of our income, and that's unacceptable and all that stuff. Well, what he didn't say was what he has done in response to that recognition. First of all, he never admitted that 95% of the income gains have gone to the top 1%, and those are his buddies. Those are the people like Larry Summers and others that he's putting in positions of political power. But what he didn't say, as he's been trying to posture as this great opponent of inequality, is that his bare minimum increase of the minimum wage would be up to $10.10 an hour. Now, if you have a family of four and you're working for that kind of money, you're still below the poverty level. So increasing the minimum wage to that level, while certainly nobody is going to decry that except libertarians, the idea that he would actually move people up in their level of poverty really doesn't do too much. And when he starts talking about preschool in one of his speeches, I heard him talking about making preschool available. His administration single-handedly has cut 57 children from the Head Start program this past year alone. So while the median income of American households has dropped almost 5% over the past year, billionaires have doubled their wealth. Obama continues to pump money into their financial system and at the same time putting increasing burdens on American, what they used to call the middle class, it's now pretty much the lower class, of pay for your own health care. You don't know that one yet, but it's coming, like you said. pay for your own education. We're not going to give you a head start anymore. Do what you can. We'll try to get you $10 an hour, but even though that's going to keep you in poverty, we're going to restructure the auto industry, if I can go back to 2009 for a minute, making sweeping benefits cuts and sweeping pay cuts as a condition for your employment. On and on we could go with all of this, but he does it with a smile, and he does it by talking very democratically and very much as an opponent of inequality. But his actions, if you pay attention to them, are precisely the opposite from someone who would be supportive of equality. And so that's probably, in my view, the latest, greatest ruse from Obama is that he opposes inequality. He doesn't oppose inequality at all. He is probably even more than Bush at this particular point a proponent of inequality in his actions by what he's done.
There is no question about that, Bob, and I wrote about his speech. It was an absolute abomination from the beginning to the end. It was full of so many lies. I simply couldn't write about them all. There were too many of them. My God, I mean, there was dozens, one after another, nonstop, from the beginning of the speech to the end of the speech, and I agree with you. He absolutely despises equality. He wants everything of any value and worth to go to the wealthiest people in the country and the corporate interests. Whether they're war profiteers, whether they're bankers, whatever their business is, he wants them to get it all, and he wants people, other people, ordinary people, entirely shut out. And indeed, I mean, he is a super con man. He's a serial liar. He's a moral coward. And because of the terrible things that have gone on since 2008, when what I call repeatedly in articles a Main Street depression. Absolutely depression. It is every bit as bad now for most people in America as things were back in the 1930s. They're terrible for ordinary people, and the wealth disparity is worse than ever. And Obama is a great proponent of this, but of course he says exactly the opposite. And I, because of all of these things, and I've written about them in so many articles about Obama, I absolutely unequivocally say, and I could prove it, chapter and verse, that Obama, by far, is the worst president America ever had, and I'll add one more thing. Whoever replaces him will be even worse.
That I don't see it going any other direction than that, Steve. Yeah, I totally agree. I don't see how, in this particular climate, any president could be anything other than a corporate elitist and be president. There's just the conditions aren't right for it. But in tagging on to what you were just saying about the inequality of wealth, there's a report that came out at the end of October, I believe, from the Southern Education Foundation, and it concluded an extensive study that in the last 8 years, which would really be the Obama years mainly, nearly half of the public school children in the United States were under the poverty wage level. So nearly half of our students coming to class are poor. And there are 17 states that are well below the poverty level, and I'm not going to name them all, but I've got the report on my desk and I was reading through it, and the poverty level is defined as below $29,000 a year for a family of four. $29,000 a year for a family of four, and yet we've got Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook making $2.27 billion a year. There's the discrepancy that you see. That's what Obama is cementing into place that other presidents have as well. But Obama is arguably one of the worst in that regard, particularly because he says one thing and does another, as they all do. But Obama's smiley face with it has fooled a lot of people about it. And I think people, you had mentioned this earlier, I think people are waking up to it. I think the wake-up is coming too slowly, and I think it's probably not going to be sufficient to make any turnaround. I think this, let's call it a totalitarian form of government that we have right now, or fascist, whatever you want to say, that's it cemented in place, and it's been cemented in place starting in the 1980s, and I think it's here to stay for a while. I don't see any other way around it at this particular point. I keep looking for these openings. I keep looking for hope. In fact, I wrote an article that I want to send out at the end of the year about hope for the future. There are some signs of hope in the sense that people are waking up, and I look primarily to my students. There's been a pretty significant shift in student attitudes that I see going on, from the me, I just want a lot of money, to I'm not so sure that this is the right way that we ought to be living our lives. There's got to be something else. And they're looking, starting to look for what other options are there in this, because I think that a lot of students are getting the sense that, wait a minute, something's not right here. I'm being left out of a whole lot here. So there are some signs of hope. But that hope, by the time that generation moves ahead and begins to take over the process, we're way down the road with this totalitarian government. So, you know, it would be great if somebody could think of various specific ways that we could turn this around. I don't see any right now, and I'm not being a pessimist. I just, honestly, I can't see any.
I was so encouraged by Occupy Wall Street, Bob, over 2 years ago, September 2011, and it just kind of faded away. And Obama, again, one of his big lies, where he publicly said he supported the things they stood for, and privately he turned the FBI and Homeland Security and other thuggish U.S. operations onto them to literally beat up on them. He conspired with local police departments to go out on the streets and beat hell out of these people, arrest them, terrorize them. So Obama's policies are polar opposite the stuff that he talks about. We really do need some kind of a national initiative, Bob. I don't believe in violence. I want to see it be nonviolent. But we really need a nonviolent national uprising, and I absolutely believe in civil disobedience. If it was good enough for Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson and some other notable Americans of the past, it certainly is good enough for me. I mean, if we don't rattle the chain, nothing is going to happen, but it needs to be strong, it needs to be nationwide, it needs to be sustained, and people have to literally put their bodies on the line, and young people especially, because, you know, they're looking forward to a future. Well, I would just say categorically, if they don't come from a well-off family, they have none. They have none. You know, exceptions prove the rule, Bob, but most of them will end up no way like they really hoped they'd end up when they went to college and thought if they got a degree, they would better themselves. It's so different than when I got through college in 1956 and then grad school in 1960. There was a lot to look forward to today, back then. But if I were going through the same things and coming out of school now, today, it would look pretty, pretty bleak, and that's the way it is for most people.
Well, especially given the way that the student loan game has been rigged for the students. And I keep trying to tell my students that, and they look at me with big eyes and open mouths because they haven't heard any of that. So they're kind of caught in a bind. You need an education if you're going to get ahead, but there is no really a goal of getting ahead, not for the bulk of us today. And yet, if you're going to try to get ahead, in all likelihood, with the rising cost of education, you're going to have to take out pretty significant student loans. But the game is backlogged on you with all of these fixes that take all your extremely high interest rates on a regular basis and pay them to the bank, and you can't get out of them. You could declare bankruptcy, but you still can't get out of your student loans. So the game is rigged against them, and I think they're beginning to see that. And in regard to the Wall Street, I was very much taken with the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I also waited for Obama and the stormtroopers of various cities to move in because, you know, if you've read Noam Chomsky for years, he has talked about how when these type of equality movements get underway and they begin to pick up momentum, invariably every time the state, whether it's the federal state or the state, sends in the troops and brutally suppresses them. And that's what we saw in Occupy Wall Street, and that's what we're seeing in Greece too, by the way, which seems to have dropped out of the news. The austerity budgets continue to be hammered against the Greek people, more social cuts, more mass layoffs, and even, gosh, I think it was just last week, the Greek parliament adapted its 2014 budget, and specifically it cuts out 3.2 billion euros of social programs and cuts another 2.1 billion euros of tax on the wealthy. So now and people are taking to the streets there, and every time they come up with a huge protest, the state reacts with increasing brutality and continues to kill people and injure them and brutally put down the protest. And there's example after example that I've saved a couple of from the news stories that I've got on the desk, but the idea is that the state responds with increasing violence when people start to increase their wherewithal to take the power back themselves, and that's what we're going to have to confront. And I agree with you, it should be a nonviolent movement of some sort, but it's going to have to be done in mass numbers. And brutality from the state has been cemented into place in the United States as well, with the increase in military budgets, specifically for police forces, and we've seen that too. I hear the music, I'll stop.
Yeah, we need to take a break. I say it all the time. People who think they can change things at the ballot box are dreaming. Dreaming. It never happened in human history with rare exceptions. Never in America. Never at all in American history. It's got to be another way. We'll take a break, Bob, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. Talking with Robert Abele. Bob, there is so much going on. My goodness, I mean, we could spend all day and we could never cover all the big issues, the horrors that are going on at home that harm so many people, and the things that the administration and Congress goes along with that go on abroad. Most people don't pay any attention to these things, or far too little. The war in Syria continues to rage. The stuff going on in the streets of Ukraine that is still going on for just about a month now. I mean, this is America's dirty hands manipulating them behind the scenes. I've got an article that is written. I won't get it out tomorrow. I want to feature my Fed article tomorrow. I've got an article going out on conflict in South Sudan. I've mentioned South Sudan briefly in previous articles. Not too often, maybe a couple of three times, and I honestly didn't know too much about it. I know the Sudan, which was the largest country in Africa until 2011, when it split in two, in the right term is balkanizing, and America wanted that, you know, divide and conquer, that sort of thing. And the oil rich areas, most of them are in the South, and the South became the part that allied with America, that America did the most manipulation of, and the North is run by an independent sovereign government that Washington wants ousted, not because of the kind of governance it has, which is certainly not pretty, but it has nothing to do with it. It's because it values its sovereign independence. And America wants all sovereign, independent countries replaced with pro-Western puppet states. That's the whole idea. You know, that was Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, what's going on in Syria right now. And North Sudan is on the target list. Well, it began with Balkanization in mid-year 2011. And now there's a civil war, or the has the look of a civil war, happening in South Sudan. It only began in mid-December, although there's been lots of strife for a very, very long time. And I checked some Sudanese history, Bob. Sudan over the years has been rocked by civil war in the 1950s for about 7 years to the early 1960s. And from 1983 to 2005, can you imagine a civil war lasting all that time? And finally, the darn thing ended. But there have been sporadic conflicts perking up. And then you had the North and the South split, and you've got a conflict in the South going on. And in just a very short period of time, it's been very vicious. A lot of people have been killed, and there's a lot at stake in what happens. And Obama sent troops over, small contingent, few dozen. But I'm absolutely convinced that more are going to be coming.
Well, that's how it always starts. We're just going to send over a few troops, and then we'll take it from there. Or we're going to send over the one I really like, although I don't hear that too much anymore. We're just going to give them some military advisors. That was Reagan's strategy in Central America. We're going to send some advisors over. Those advisors happen to come with a wad full of cash in one hand, a wad full of weapons in the other, and a bunch of troops behind them if needed. And I don't think you're seeing that in Ukraine yet, but certainly Sudan. That's the start there. Of America's footprint there. We follow the oil and we follow the control. And if the control is elusive, we tighten up, ratchet down even harder, whatever way, up until military action in order to do that. It'll be interesting to see what happens in Ukraine, because people in Ukraine have caught on to the fact that these protests are made in America as well. That the and the European Union, I guess I should add that, they're coming to represent, and a lot of the protesters are representing the interests of the oligarchs there and the far right groups. The rise of the far right in the Ukraine is fueled by America in order to get a wedge in Ukraine to prevent Russia from having more influence. And there's a lot of evidence for that as well. And I'm not an expert in Ukraine by any means, but from what I've been able to pick up. The idea is that the oligarchs and the people who want the European trade union and Western money are the ones that are fueling these protests in Ukraine. They're not grassroots protests. They're formalized protests that come from another party outside of Ukraine that has interest in Ukraine.
Oh, that's exactly right, Bob. I wrote a few times on Ukraine. There are three opposition groups, and if Ukraine turns west instead of east, they have a lot to gain personally. So it's their own self-interest that's motivating their opposition, and ordinary people are being suckered with propaganda, including a lot of false stories circulating. Well, so far, Vladimir Putin in Russia has outfoxed and outmaneuvered the West because he gave the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, exactly what Ukraine needs, a $15 loan by buying Ukrainian bonds and cheap gas, cheap natural gas. He cut the price by one-third. One-third. That's a major, major concession. And Ukraine's economy is in very serious trouble. It's got some loan refinancing coming up. It needed a lifeline desperately, or it could go bankrupt. Well, if it's in debt to Western bankers, I see nothing wrong with stiffing them, to put it bluntly. I mean, a lot of it, I mean, they literally want to get countries permanently debt-entrapped, which is the term, just the way they want to get students debt-entrapped with student loans. They do it to countries, they do it to communities, they do it to ordinary people, and this is a dirty game, and Putin came with carrots, not sticks. So far, Putin is the winner, and hopefully Ukraine will come out the better of this, but it really is a very ugly situation going on. And then, you know, Bob, U.S. officials and EU officials showed up in Kiev and went out on the street with protesters and joined them, including an Undersecretary of State, Victoria Nuland, John McCain. Superhawk showed up in McCain. There was a big Sunday demonstration / protest, and he spoke to the crowd.
Wow.
And I commented in one of my articles, just imagine if Russian or Chinese officials showed up and addressed, say, a U.S. protest crowd in Washington against the policies of the Obama administration. How long would it take before they were arrested, roughed up, detained, and summarily deported from the country if they weren't thrown in the pokey and just left there?
Yeah, throw them in Guantanamo. That's probably what would happen to them. Well, you know, you can certainly see what the direction of American arrogance in that regard, just from this past Thursday, where the Senate voted to authorize another $633 billion in military spending.
Oh, yeah.
And at the same time, the budget for the year for food stamps and the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, was only $76.4 billion. So if you compare those two numbers, $633 billion for new military spending, $76 billion for spending on the people. Now, we know that over 1 million, and depending upon the figures, up to 2 million Americans are going to lose their sole income at the end of this month.
Yep.
Because of their unemployment benefits. That cost us somewhere in the ballpark of about $25 billion. Okay, let's make those figures work again. $633 billion in new military spending. That's an over and above what we normally spend. And a mere $25 billion for benefits for the people being cut, so that we can put more money into the military. And Chalmers Johnson said it best. I heard this from an interview with him shortly before he died, and I know he wrote it in one of his trilogy books. You can either have democracy at home or military imperialism abroad, but you can't have both. And I think we've come to that point now where we really do have to make a decision, because, well, actually the decision is being made for us. But people have to wake up to, we're not just at the crossroads anymore of having to discuss this openly. We're past that point. We are now moving down the road of an imperialism abroad and not a democracy at home. And that's what we left off talking about at the break, that's where we had finally come to. So we've got all kinds of legislation that covers combat pay and some of its reductions, giving more ships, more aircraft, more military bases, more missiles, and nothing to the people whatsoever. Let them eat cake, I guess, huh?
Oh, indeed, Bob. I do remember that quote, and I think it was in, he wrote a trilogy, and I think the last one was called Nemesis.
Right.
Nemesis, the goddess of...
Hubris. The goddess
of pride. Of hubris, hubris and vengeance. And, I think he said in the book, I reviewed the book. It was some years ago, and I had Chalmers on another program that I hosted some years ago, and very sadly he passed away a few years ago. It was a great loss. I'd love to be able to have him on the program now and hear his comments. And that's exactly, I mean, you got the quote exactly right. I mean, you can't have both. You can either have the policies that America is endorsing, the imperial policies abroad, and the stuff that goes on at home as well, or you can have these democracy or these horrors going on. And other people have said the same thing in different ways. But this is what we have, and it keeps getting worse, not better. And I think it was in his book Nemesis that quote came out, and he was very, very negative on the outlook for America's future. And he basically said, you know, things happen much faster now than way back centuries ago. But, you know, all empires met the same fate, and he said America will also meet the same fate as previous ones. The Roman Empire went down. The last one to go down was the Soviet Union, and Britain went down. Britain has fragments of its old empire, and the Soviet Union was the last one. And America's turn is coming. And I agree that I think there's absolutely no question that America's empire will go, and what the reverberations will be when it happens, I don't know. I mean, we really could have a global catastrophe, maybe a world war,
a terrible world war, and then the survivors are going to have to plan in advance for what type of life they want after that. Assuming that we could get through all of this without having a worldwide nuclear conflagration, we have to plan in advance, okay, what kind of society do we really want to see? What kind of society do we want when this ultimately collapses? And everybody knows that it can't be sustained. The elites have wrung every penny out of everybody in America to pay for their fun little wars abroad, but there's nothing left. So what do you do when you hit that point? You really do have a Roman Empire moment, because one of the causes, not the only cause, but one of the causes of the Roman Empire's decline, according to Eugene Weber, the historian from UCLA, is their overexpenditure on military. They overextended. They overextended, and they overextended. And that was one of the results, that they collapsed from within because of their own overextension. And then you've got corporations that are allegedly think tanks. The Rand Corporation, this was actually last month, came out with their major study, which really underscores everything that you and I are talking about. If you really want to know what the Pentagon is thinking, you go to the Rand Corporation and look on their website and look at their latest reports. And back in November, they had released their latest report about what Obama's been calling the pivot to the Southeast Asia. They have set up a whole program in conjunction with Pentagon thought analysts as well to start with anti-ship missile systems that they want to deploy from Japan to Indonesia through Australia, in order to block the waterways into and out of China. Now, they're not suggesting this as a possible military game to look at the possibility of doing. The latest Rand report from November says we're already doing this, that we plan to stop Chinese ships from going in and out. Okay, so we can go on with this. We could do this. Japan is doing military exercises. Interestingly, 3 days after the Rand report comes out, very public report that people were talking about, then you've got China coming up with its ADIZ, China's Air Defense Authorization Zone, 3 days after the Rand report. And then you come up last week, or was it this past week, with U.S. and Chinese naval vessels in near collision with each other because the U.S. was interfering, coming into the waters of a Chinese military maneuver, and their boats almost collided with one another. You got all these stuff going on, provoking a war, okay? So you got Obama attempting to provoke a war. You've got the Rand Corporation, one of the largest U.S. elite think tanks, meaning economic elite, saying not just plan it, let's get it into gear. And then you've got Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Iraq continues to go on, Sudan, and all these other places. There is the possibility of the overextension. Obama wants to pull out of the Syrian debacle, especially once it was shown that he was lying about who was using chemical weapons. He wants to avoid that, but at the same time wants to keep pressure on Iran, wants to stay in Afghanistan, wants to continue with drone strikes and involvement in Pakistan. At a certain point, if we get into a war in Southeast Asia, we're going to probably bite off more than we can chew, because the Chinese are not any force to be toyed with. I mean, they're going to have something to say militarily in response. So there could be the stress point there, the pivot to Southeast Asia. But you've got these corporations that are calling themselves think tanks saying, let's not just talk about this, let's plan and let's do this. And there would be the overextension. So it's just a guess, but that's what I'm kind of thinking now.
Well, Jama Johnson says the same thing, and I think that the word he uses is overstretch. where you literally go beyond what your capability is, and you get yourself in trouble. And that's exactly what's happening with America. America has well over 1,000 military bases. A lot of them are secret, and they're simply not listed. You can't find names or anything, and some of them are shared bases with home countries. Certainly that's the case in places like Pakistan. I don't know how many shared bases America has with Pakistan, but even in the UK, America has shared bases with Britain, and well over 1,000, and in something like 150-odd countries, maybe even more than that, maybe 160 or 70. Literally, U.S. forces everywhere on the planet, practically, and the audacity of America to go into the waters of another country, especially one like China, and Russia, of course, Eastern Russia is in that area, and to literally operate like those waters are your own. And yesterday on the program, Bob, we talked about what if China or Russia sent their warships into the Gulf of Mexico, what kind of response do you think they would get? It certainly wouldn't be a friendly one.
No, it would be a friendly one at all. And you know what? The Americans would rally behind that type of action. How dare they come into our territories? And so that there you get that kind of imperialistic mindset that seems to be sewn into American culture. What we do is okay for us. What others might do to us is not okay. So you have that whole problem that goes on in American culture. The world is ours, and if we decide to do something with it, then that's our business, and nobody should be saying anything about it. So, but we wouldn't have it happen to us. If Canadian troops started lining up on the border of Canada saying we're doing this for defense, we'd attack them tomorrow. So that's a problem that we're going to have to overcome. That whole militarism, which is part of totalitarianism, which is part of fascism, that whole militaristic thing is going to have to die. And it may have to die the hard way if the United States doesn't just get a bloody nose, but actually loses significantly in its worldwide global attempt for dominance. Well, then we could see something come from that. The other angle to that, too, is, of course, that we haven't touched upon yet was all the NSA spying that has been talked about, that particularly in Australia and Canada now, the NSA is in there engaging in spying operations because when they go to other countries, they're not bound by the very limited and inadequate American laws regarding spying. But there they are. I mean, Edward Snowden's release, last few releases, talked about the concentration of the NSA spying in Australia as well. And they're really trying to get everywhere. For the document I'm referring to is, I think it's pronounced SIGINT, S-I-G-I-N-T. It's
yeah.
Strategy for 2012 to 2016, I think, those 4 years, where their whole idea is that, well, the law hasn't kept pace with what we're doing, and so forget the law. I mean, that's what the document says. So let's, in other words, we know what we're doing is illegal and shouldn't be done, but we're going to do it anyway till the law catches up with us. You never see any reference there to anything about legal rights or human rights or civil rights or the Fourth Amendment. It's just completely business-oriented. This is what we're going to do. And the thing that intrigued me most was the release this month of one of the Snowden documents about the NSA program in the United States called Co-Traveler, which tracks everyone who carries a cell phone, and it can even interact with your cell phone when it's turned off. And it doesn't track where you're calling. It tracks what other cell phones you are close to geographically. So this notion of freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of association guaranteed by the First Amendment, is not just a Fourth Amendment issue. It's a First Amendment issue now when they're tracking who you are even physically close to, and they're putting that into their records of who you are and what's going on. You have a totalitarian state. Now, how do you get out from under that? Well, if you can't beat the military, short of a unified push, you can certainly start at home, and you can certainly push against the NSA in what they're doing. And I think that there is some, I don't want to say ammunition, there's plenty of ammunition, there's some impetus for that. People seem to be more interested in that these days than they do in the military because it affects them more directly. So maybe that would be a good place to start. Realize what the NSA is doing. Realize that now they're not just entrenching upon the Fourth Amendment, but now the First Amendment, freedom of association. Realize to the degree that they do that, you are not free to organize any type of protest because they're going to know what you're doing, and therefore that First Amendment is completely undermined as well. So I think when that starts coming down, perhaps we've got one of the leverages that we can use to try to get a new America with overturning the NSA and then connecting that with this global overreach with regard to our own terrorist imperialist agenda.
Oh, I hope so, Bob. I think all the time about what is the threshold of pain that has to be crossed in people's lives to realize that the policies of government, especially out of Washington, are harming them so much? And when will a realization dawn at the same time or around the same time that if they don't do something about it themselves, then nothing is going to happen to change things? What will it take to get people to realize this in enough numbers and decide, my God, I mean, they're killing me. If we don't get together, and people can get together very easily, it's happened many times in the past in America and, of course, around the world, if people don't do this, their futures are going down the drain, and it will look as bad as things are for them today. It's going to be a lot worse tomorrow. And again, as I compare things today to the way they were when I was a young guy growing up, it's just worlds apart, worlds apart.
Well, you've just asked the $64,000 question, you know, how much pain can you undergo before you decide this is enough? I have to say something. There has to be some type of pushback. There has to be a change that occurs. And I guess the Americans haven't hit that threshold yet, at least the ones that are in a position that they could do anything about it. Maybe that's what it's going to take. I would have thought that the crash of 2008 would have left enough people out on a limb that they would want to be crawling back to the trunk and hang on to the trunk of democratic rights and freedoms, but that hasn't happened yet. So I'm hoping that the latest NSA surveillance things that people seem to be taking an interest in more, at least it's in the news more, and perhaps once we start clearly overreaching, actually the Americans do know we're overreaching militarily. The American polls regularly show that the vast majority of Americans, anywhere from 56 to 70%, depending upon the poll, are opposed to our military adventures now, as opposed to 2001 when we first went into Afghanistan. So Americans do have a sense that not only are we going the wrong way, they're specific about what they understand. We're going the wrong way militarily, and of course the high numbers, even higher numbers in the polls, are opposed to the NSA surveillance that's going on. So there is opposition there. The next step is to organize that opposition into some type of groups that are allowed to or continue to give themselves the power to protest and unify with other groups to do it. I think that's really the first step, and education is a big part of that step.
Oh, it really is, Bob, but I don't have enough time to go into it, but in my Banker Occupation book, I have a chapter on 1968 in France, and in a nutshell, for about a month, I think it began in May, as I recall in the book, in writing about it, for about a month, it literally brought the French government to a halt. Charles de Gaulle was president then. The protests on the street where people took over factories, they were out on the street, they took over big cities, a tremendous percentage of the population, and they literally brought the de Gaulle government to its knees, and they did it nonviolently, and it showed they took over universities, they took over public places. It shows that when people decide they simply don't want to take this stuff anymore, that they literally can have the change that they want. Well, they didn't quite go far enough. They let the protests ebb before it really was getting them a very, very viable conclusions, important ones, and they let the energy wane, and the French government won out in the end. But if they had sustained it a while longer, they literally could have had things that they wanted, and they didn't get it. But it almost happened in France. It can happen anywhere. It can happen in America, and I certainly hope it will in my lifetime, Bob. I hope I live long enough to see it.
Well, I'd like to see it, and I would like to be a part of it as it goes in whatever contribution I can make. So now, after we've talked about that, especially for the last 10 minutes, do you think that we're in the NSA's files with all this now? I would think.
They are some of my most loyal listeners, Bob. And readers, of course.
I just looked at the clock, and I want to get this in real quick. It's not directly related to what we've been discussing, but one of your regular guests and friends, Harvey Wasserman, has an article that was in Counterpunch last week called Japan's New Fukushima Fascism. I think it's an excellent article. He does two things in this. He shows how the Fukushima disaster is out of control with its dumping of radioactive waste into the Pacific and into the air and onto the land. But he also outlines something very interesting that I'd not read before, and that is in Japan, there's a new state secret act which allows the state to punish people who talk about Fukushima by up to 10 years in prison. One of the Japanese legislators says is that this represents a coup d'etat and the recreation of a fascist state in Japan. So there's a lot of volatility in Japan about the Fukushima issue, and Harvey Wasserman points that out really well, and also points out what's going on in Fukushima, and it is a really serious worldwide disaster that nobody is talking about in the mainstream media. So every time we can, we got to talk about Fukushima.
Oh, absolutely, Bob. It really is nightmarish, and it doesn't just affect Japan. This stuff is circulating around the world, not cutting down on freedoms, but the radiation from the Fukushima. Bob, I wish we had more time. We're out of time. Many, many thanks. I'll shoot you an email. I look forward to getting you back next month in the new year, and I'll wish you and your family a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you, Steve.
Thank you, Bob. Join us next week. I wish all my listeners a happy holiday and a good new year. We'll be on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.